Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. It's Monday, and that means it's time for Aftershock. That's right. It's another Aftershock Monday episode. A couple books coming out from Aftershock this Wednesday. Cold War number 2 from Christopher Sabala and Hayden Sherman is going to be on the stands. I'm going to save that book for our New Comics Wednesday episode because the other book that's coming out is Betrothed number 1. And I'm lucky enough to have the writer, Sean Lewis, joining me. So this episode, we're just going to focus on Betrothed. And I've read the first issue. It's exciting. And I'm going to turn it over to Sean, and he's going to tell us how he got into comics and his background, and then we'll get into the book itself. So first off, Sean, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
No, it's great. I always love having people that work with Aftershock because I know they have a good judgment. Because Aftershock's such a great company to work with.
Yeah, they seem like they've been gaining a lot of trust really quickly. They've been really great to work with. I mean, they're only the second publisher I've actually done a book with. So I've been very, really, really lucky so far with my experiences.
Yeah, that's cool. So give us some of your background. Did you grow up reading comics? Did you always want to be a writer? How did all that come about?
Yeah, you know, I think deep down I did. Like I grew up, I lived in the same house as, I had an older uncle who lived with us, who was a huge comic book collector / metalhead guy. And I would just like raid his box, for all his like Sandman books and like the old Transmetropolitan books. So he was a big Vertigo and DC fan. And at school, you know, I would draw up little cartoons, and comic books of like, our teachers and stuff and sell them for like a quarter, you know, things like that you do when you're like, you know, in second or third grade in Catholic school. And, yeah, I had no idea how you actually got into writing comic books though, like as a job. So it went away for a really long time. And then, I've worked primarily as a playwright for the last like 15 to 20, almost 20 years now. And, I lucked out. I was working on a play and we had a projection designer who was doing, you know, animations for the show, and they all looked like these Silver Age Superman comics. And so me and him started talking about our love of comic books one day, and we were like, well, maybe we should try and make a comic book together. You know, it was a great night, I would say, because we didn't realize like how hard that would be. And also like, what do you do when you have a comic? And so we made this comic book based on, basically like if saints kind of were reincarnated and came back to Earth now. And, we made a full issue of it and we sent it. We didn't know what to do. So I just literally started sending it to publishers, you know, stupidly in some ways as if DC is going to open a random PDF. And, weirdly enough, Image Comics did open that random email. And yeah, I was off on tour with a show and I got a phone call from Eric Stevenson from Image, and he was like, are you the guy who did Saints? And I'm like, yeah. And he was just like, how would you like to do that at Image? And that's basically how the comics writing started to happen is, we made that first one and Image came on board, and, I've done 2 books since with Image, and then Aftershock's my first book with that's a non-Image book.
Wow. Cool. What made you decide to go to Aftershock for this title?
You know, part of it is like with Image, you're putting together the whole team. You're kind of like a project manager, like, you know, you're bringing the artists and the colorists and bringing a full project to Eric and their staff. And they're amazing about their judgment and curation is incredible. The advice and support they give is amazing. And I was having a hard time finding an artist for this book. I just couldn't, but every time I reached out to somebody, it just didn't really work out. And, my uncle runs a comic book shop. The same uncle who I used to raid through his comics. He now owns Comic Book Shop.
Cool.
And, he was like, have you heard about Aftershock comics? And I actually didn't know much about them. And then he gave me a copy of Animosity, and I dug Animosity.
Yeah, that's cool. It's kind of what I've been hearing from a lot of creators, and it's what I've talked with Mike Martz about, extensively as well. It's like, you know, at Image, there's a certain amount of heavy lifting you have to do on your own, and that's fine. That they're great at what they do, and you have like complete freedom. But at Aftershock, there's a little more infrastructure there. So if you're not looking to necessarily do all that heavy lifting and promoting on your own, there's a little more support. So that's really cool. I will say,
yeah, I'm gonna I wouldn't say it's infrastructure so much as it's just different models. Like, I think because the way that Image operates is they're like so 100% creator owned.
Right.
That it makes sense that it's like, put together the whole project, make it your dream project, and then we'll go with it. Where, you know, Aftershock feels, at least in my experience so far, is like kind of a hybrid between Image and a Marvel or a DC, where you're still retaining a large portion of the ownership, but you're really in partnership with them.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, in terms of that. So, like, because of that, I think it they have to kind of have that part of their say in it, of how the art and the letters and everything will go. I think they're both great. They just kind of approach the business in two different ways.
Yeah, I would agree with you 100%. I think they're both great, and they both have their place in the industry. It's almost like, if you want to have a little more feedback or a little more, you know, back and forth, you know, like if there's a certain right. project, you're just, wow, you know, I almost have it. I'm like 80% of the way there. You know, what am I missing, you know, as a creator? And that you can bounce ideas off those guys. Cause really what you're doing is you're partnering up with them, and what they're bringing to the table is all this experience, you know, 50, whatever, you know, between Joe and Mike, it's probably over 50 years of experience in the industry, right. what works and what doesn't. So yeah, really, really cool. Now, I do have to ask before we start talking about the book in particular. So you said like Sandman and Transmetropolitan, and then you mentioned selling these creator-made or your own, you know, made comics at second grade. You were – I mean, Sandman and Transmet, like second grade, was that – I mean, that's a hefty start for a young
man. Definitely. I mean, Alan Moore's Swamp Thing is probably one of the first comic books I ever read, which is like super hallucinogenic. Like, if people remember, like – his saga of the Swamp Thing.
Oh yeah, cake. For sure.
That's probably one of the earliest ones, and it freaked me out. My uncle was really obsessed with Swamp Thing.
How old were you when you read
so
that?
Yeah, I was. I probably would have been no older than 7 or 8 when I was wow. reading that.
Wow, you really jumped to the deep end.
Yeah, I mean, I eventually found my way over to like Chris Claremont's X-Men. That became like a huge obsession of mine when my uncle moved out to his own apartment, and I had to like get comic books now from the local, you know, like CVS or right. drugstore yep. off the rack. Like, but yeah, and the first ones I read, it definitely was a change when I started reading things that weren't Vertigo books.
Right.
And like darker DC books. I was like, oh, okay, they're not always trying to like scare you and really like push the limits of your brain. Like there's other options to this.
Yeah, I can remember. I mean, it's kind of, so I went to Catholic school too, so I definitely can relate there. But I remember like, and to this day, one of the titles that I love from DC back in the early to mid 80s was Vigilante. You know, and I was like 10 when I was reading that. He's out there like killing people. And I know it was for mature readers, but the guy that owned the 7-Eleven down the street from my house was a huge comic fan. So he didn't just get like newsstand stuff, because Vigilante was a direct market book, and he got direct market books because he collected himself. So that's the only reason I,
right.
Because as a kid, you know, there was a comic shop in my town. I never would have found that book if it wouldn't been for the fact that he had direct market books. So it's really
no, funny. Absolutely. Like like I said, like when my uncle left, like my options were like old school Archie or Disney comics or basically just X-Men. And so, yeah. Like X-Men became like my big obsession after right. that.
That's kind of an easy choice at that point.
Yeah. No, I loved all of those years of X-Men.
All right. Well, let's get into the comic that you have coming out from Aftershock: Betrothed. Why don't you sure. give us the quick elevator pitch? What's the story all about?
Sure. Basically, Kieran and Tamara are high school seniors. They don't know each other super well, and they're about to turn 18. And on the eve of their 18th birthdays, they find out that in another dimension, they are both the leaders of two warring armies, and they are betrothed to be married to each other for peace, or they're going to have to fight to the death for one of their armies to win.
All right, so a little bit of a Romeo and Juliet story. I think I've seen that term thrown around a lot in relation to this book, and I think even within the book itself, issue one, there's some references to that. So, you know, that's a
right.
classic.
Absolutely.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, you know, a lot of my background is in theater, so it's hard to like escape Shakespeare, and it definitely has that kind of star-crossed lovers, kind of how does fate play into relationships and love and passion as like a larger thematic.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. I made a very, you know, classic Shakespearean, and you know, he used it to explore the themes of, you know, is does love outweigh, you know, duty and things like that. Are those some of the same kind of themes you're looking to explore here? Are you trying to branch out and build on that, or is something some themes completely different?
I think it's going to branch out and build on it. I mean, I wanted to do especially a book that was fun, like that very much leaned towards being really fun and action based. You know, the three comics I've done previously have really been like my own personal obsession pieces. I grew up Catholic, so saints and, you know, looking at what belief and religion were was really important to me. I did a sci-fi book after that called The Few, which I was just really fascinated with, like, how quiet could a dystopic sci-fi book be? Like, how beautiful and literature-based could you make it? And then the most recent book I've done is Coyotes, which was a big kind of like, how much popular culture and folklore and myth could I put together in a story about borders, and kind of women and predatory behavior. So then I think after doing books that were that heavy and that intense, I came around at the Trove and I was like, I kind of want to tell some jokes and have some fun and kind of explore love, like actually just two people who are trying to connect with each other. So like Romeo and Juliet plays into it because it sets up a good, you know, tension between the characters of like, are they going to be able to survive and end up together or not? But I really, at the base of it, I just love the idea of the universe being, you know, left to the devices of teenage hormones. I just don't think that's a really fun jumping off point for a comic book.
Is that why you chose the, like, two teenagers? I mean, in issue one, we're introduced to, you know, the two main characters. We also get a glimpse into the worlds that they're, you know, the supposedly the future leaders of. And it's an interesting introduction into these worlds, like you said, because we're introduced to them as high school seniors. And, you know, when you're a high school senior, you think you kind of know everything. And yeah, I'm grown up now. And, you know, but really, with the perspective of time, you realize you really don't know anything. And so here we are,
right,
being introduced to two teenagers that are representing these worlds. That's, in a way, a little chaotic and a little crazy way to kind of be our gateway and our eyes into these two worlds, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely correct on that. And I also just kind of love, you know, the fact that when you're a teenager, everything feels like the end of the world. Like every small thing feels like the world is ending. So I just was kind of like, well, what happens if the world actually is ending?
Like,
how do you deal with it as a teenager if it's like, yeah, you didn't start a problem with that, but now the universe is over. What do you do now?
Yeah, that's completely true. So, and setting these future world, these future rulers rather, of these respective worlds in modern day high school, that's what appealed to you about just the drama of high school and really making it life and death?
Yeah, I mean, I did like that I could go from a world that's really, you know, superficially dramatic, but actually kind of mundane. Like high school, if, as we all remember, like when we wanted to get the hell out of high school, it was because it was really mundane. It was like, yeah, every day, same period, and the same people. And like, what choices do I have? And yeah, I know everything. Why are these people talking to me? To then bringing people into a completely new universe that both the narrators and the audience don't know anything about, where suddenly like, they're like, this is massive. This world's huge. And I don't know anything. So like as a writer, it's kind of fun to go like, oh, I'm in a contemporary high school scene where they're just trying to figure out like if they have enough time to get to their trigonometry class. And then I can jump to like an intergalactic war on the next like splash page. Like as a writer, it's just kind of fun to be able to move back and forth between those worlds.
And are we going to move back and forth? Because it, based on the first issue, it's like we see them on Earth, but then we see them take a journey and they're asked, as you mentioned, to perhaps they're getting ready to fight to the death, but we've seen them be it's like a love hate attraction thing that we've already seen.
Right.
So is it going to continue to flip back and forth? Cause I do still, I mean, the scenes in the high school were so enjoyable. I do still as a reader want to see more of that. Are we going to be flipping back and forth?
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of that. I enjoy them too. You know, like they're really fun to write, and that tension is too interesting to me to not use. So yeah, they find ways that they keep journeying. I can't speak today, that they keep moving back and forth between the two realities. I mean, I just kept thinking about when I was writing it, like I had just started reading some of the new, I was catching up on the new Archies, like the Mark Waid,
right.
Arc. And I just really loved them. And I'd never really read Archie or thought about Archie or cared. And I've never seen Riverdale, but like, I know it's become more of a thing. You know, I grew up more in the Beverly Hills 90210, you know, decades of years. And so there's something about that world, and I loved Heathers, and I'm like, oh, I like the idea of having my high school drama. But there's also like space operas that I've always been really obsessed with. So it's kind of, you know, a lot of the books I've been making have been mashups of the things I'm obsessed with that don't seem to go together. And then it basically, my job ends up being like, how do I make these two worlds work together seamlessly and in a really either fun or exciting and challenging way? And I think Matroza, like, you know, I'm definitely been leaning much more. I'm like, how much fun can I have with this balance?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first issue was a lot of fun. There's some really great dialogue and really great character moments between Kieran and Tamara. But also so intriguing. Yeah, you're welcome. So intriguing because we get some clues, and I know I don't want to completely give it away, but we get some clues in the first issue that our two main characters, they weren't exactly – they can't relate to us, you know, to you or I in a regular way of having, you know, parents and, you know, being born in a traditional way and growing up there. You know, there's mysteries there. There's things to be explored. And I think even when you compare them to inhabitants of their own worlds, that's probably going to be the case. You know, they are different. They, in a way, were created and came to be in a different way for this purpose of being the rulers. So I have a feeling there's going to be tension there too, because, you know, not only are they being introduced to their worlds and, you know, they're the two main characters, but there are POV characters, but there's got to be tension because they're being told all this, hey, you're the ruler of this world. But in a way, they're not even going to be able to relate to the own people that they're supposed to rule because they've never been in that world before. Plus, add on top of that, their non-traditional, you know, formation of being, let's say. That was completely intriguing, and I can't wait to learn more about that. Was that something you were conscious of when you were writing the story, or did it just kind of happen organically?
I mean, I think it happened organically. I think, you know, most of the time my first drafts, a lot of the first drafts make their way into the final, and the first drafts are usually like really overwritten straight from the gut, like just like every idea I possibly have. So I think like that stuff, like the idea of them, of the two characters in their own separate ways being engineered by their people to be the leader, was something that just came out and I was like, that's cool and different and kind of weird. I don't know why I wrote that, but then it was just like, okay, I like it. So now I have to figure out how is it useful to the overall drama. If that makes sense, like that's kind of how the drafts work for me, is I get all the guts and all the ideas. Cause I think if you, for me at least, and like I teach writing occasionally, I think if you start, like editing yourself and trying to make the perfect draft from the beginning, you actually can leave out some of the magic. Like sometimes it's the weirder ideas that we have that are just gnawing at us that you're like, there's no way that could work. Like I got to get rid of that. I've never seen a story that has that. That's actually what makes your story come alive, because it's like, because other people too recognize it and go like, I've seen a world like this. Like I've seen a space opera before, but it's like this part of the space opera is new. So now I understand enough rules that like, I don't need exposition on like most of these things, but this is a new exciting thing for me to learn. So yeah, once that stuff came out, I was like, okay, I have to investigate this a lot more because I think this could be a jewel for my audience. And it also started to bring up the realities of, you know, what you mentioned is like amongst their own people, like they're annoying in a way that teenagers can be annoying to people who are not teenagers anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Like even though they're supposed to be the rulers, even in this other world, it's like you're kids and you've been human kids for like a long time. Like we're not just dealing with like children of our own species. Like you've basically been raised around other human beings. So like you have all the annoying shit that we don't like about them as well.
Yeah, I mean, they're trying to relate to their, you know, their own subjects, and the subjects would be like, "What the hell are you talking about? Like, what's American Idol? Like, what are you, you know, what's YouTube? What the hell are you talking about, kid?" Yeah, I totally get that.
Exactly. And I think that will get exacerbated as, like, you know, you meet a couple of their friends that Tamara and Kieran have made and unearthed, and they kind of come along for the ride, and they also become a good counterpoint for that, with, like, the other aliens, you know, the other people on their native lands are seeing, you know, like a kid who runs around and is called Fat Andy and readily accepts it as his name, you know, and is really neurotic and nebbish, and, like, you have this warrior tribe who's just like, what is this kid's deal? Like, why would people behave like this?
Yeah, no frame of reference. It's great because, I mean, what we're talking about here is, you know, we mentioned Romeo and Juliet, we mentioned Shakespeare to start, and maybe there's that kernel, you know, of at the heart of the story. But then you're adding these layers, you know, you're putting, oh, well, they're teenagers. Oh, well, they were engineered to be the leaders of people. Oh, well, they grew up somewhere else. Oh, well, they're either going to love each other or hate each other or fight to the death, you know, and it just starts building. And do you find that that's a great way to make the your stories relatable to a wider audience? Like, it gives them, you know, a lot of different choices of what they can relate to or where they can see themselves.
I mean, I could see how it could do that. I know for me, it's much more that it keeps me from getting bored. You know, like the more layers, the more full the world is, I'm like, oh man, I could write this for, you know, 5 or 10 years because it just keeps growing. And it's just exciting because when I sit down to write, you know, comics are so fun. I'm like, I just don't want it ever to get to a point where it feels like a job. Like, I have had writing gigs that feel like jobs, you know, in other media. And even though you're writing, you're kind of doing your passion. You're like, I'm kind of just painting by numbers to get the audience to just kind of appreciate what I'm doing and make the people hiring me happy. And I'm like, I don't want to do that with comics. Like, this is such a gift. So in a lot of ways, it's like every time I'm sitting down, I'm just kind of going like, how much deeper can I get in the world? And how much more can I be surprised by it? Because if I'm creating it and I'm surprised, the audience is going to, has to be, you know? So those things just give me more things where I'm like, it just becomes more fun for me to, like, explore.
Well, I'm going to give you a huge compliment here, Sean. Cause, you know, I talk to a lot of creators and, you know, talking about wanting to keep it fresh and wanting to challenge yourself and have it not be a job. There's two other writers that I've talked to, and they're both, pretty good friends, that have specifically mentioned that in interviews before. And, those two would be Scott Snyder and Charles Soule. So you're in really good company. I'm sure you aspire someday to, you know, be that big of a name.
Oh man, that would be a dream. I mean, they're both amazing, and they're also kind of both fascinating because they're also like novelists and short fiction writers. So like, I imagine there's an element of that plays into it. That, you know, when you've worked in some other media, it's like, I don't know, there's something special about comics. It really is more fun than I expected it to be. So it's just like, how do you keep this kind of pure for yourself?
Yeah, you've got to constantly be striving to find new ways. And Tom King's another one. He's told me probably 100 times that he loves experimenting with the, you know, the way he tells stories, you know, doing right. things differently, a sideways issue.
He's an amazing example of it. I mean, what he's been doing between Mr. Miracle and the Vision series is really, I mean, is a real testament to that.
Exactly. Well, we're getting off on a tangent. I just feel like you and I have so much in common. We could probably sit here and talk comics all day, but let's steer it back to Betrothed. I want to talk a little bit about the artist you have on the book. You mentioned that you were having a hard time finding an artist, and then, you know, you brought the project to Aftershock, and they were the ones that introduced you to Steve Yu.
Yeah, absolutely. They basically, you know, Mike Martz, who's the editor-in-chief over there, we had, you know, I started going back and forth with him and Lee Kramer, who's his partner, and just kind of building up the text and the world to a point where he felt really comfortable. And then, you know, Mike gets approached by a local artist, and he also obviously knows a ton. So he just started sending me files, like just Dropbox files, and going like, what do you think of this person's art? What do you think of this person's art? What do you think of this person's art? And so, you know, I would spend days just kind of flipping through, you know, sequential art samples and going like, there's something interesting about this. And we go back and forth. And I saw Steve's work and I was just like, I don't know. I mean, most things I do are gut. And I was just like, this feels like the world. Like, I could see, you know, it has a bit of, it has a bit of a manga kind of feel to it.
Definitely.
What Steve does. And for, I just was like, I don't know, I find manga really fun and lighthearted in a way. So I was like, even though there's like going to be war and death and there's a lot of heavy stuff, I think manga is also very action based, but the fun, I was like, oh, this will be able to keep the high school scenes really light. And then when we go to the war scenes, it won't seem like a dramatic shift. Do you know what I mean? Like, if it's, I worried at times that if it was hyper realistic, that it would be hard for the audience, even without realizing it, to go from like, oh, we're in a completely silly, ridiculous high school scene, and then suddenly I'm going to watch someone, you know, get bludgeoned to death on page 9. That making that shift can sometimes be harder than I think people realize when they're reading a book. So yeah, I just thought Steve's work on that would work really well. He works really fast.
Yeah, I think
that's been something I've realized. I'm just like, man, he's like an insanely fast artist.
I did not know that about him. That's good to know. But I will
say, yeah, no, the speed at which he turns in the line work, I'm just like, in some ways, I'm like, slow down, dude, because by the time he turns in the line work, we start talking about like, where's the script for issue 5, and I'm like,
still in my head.
Give me a weekend.
Yeah, I will say that. You know, I think Steve's a great choice too, because as you were talking about, you know, that manga influence. The thing about manga, it's like it's very much a young look, right? So,
right.
Like you were saying, hyper realistic, and not just necessarily going from high school scenes to, you know, more of a dramatic scene, or, you know, a scene of war and conflict, battle, what have you. I feel like in manga, it's very easy to tell who the kids are versus a hyper realistic style. There's time they draw teenagers and you're really like, is that a teenager? I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's easy to lose sight of that.
Right.
No,
I think that's really true. I mean, a good example of that even is like My Cadet You from Boom. It's like, it uses a similar style, I think, to give a much more, youthful appeal to the book itself.
Right.
Like the whole book has like a young energy the moment you pick it up. Because you're like, oh, this is a kid. This is a book about the kids. Like the energy of the book is literally younger, is adolescent.
Yeah, that's
which I think is an interesting thing to do for an audience, is being like, right from the moment you start turning the pages, you're like, oh, this is energy.
Right.
This is a different energy than I'm used to in my day.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So, did Steve come on the project early enough that he helped you with character design and kind of the look of the worlds? Like, how did that process, or did you change some stuff after he came on? How did that, like, once you guys got hooked
up? It's been a lot of back and forth. You know, I knew that that one tribe was very barbarian, and I knew that the other tribe was very hyper technology. But you had like one that looked super advanced and one that looked like Conan the Barbarian. So I was able to give those breakdowns to him. But you know, a lot of times it's the character designs, you know, he's also, I like him, he's no nonsense. So like if I write in something, he's just like, what exactly is, what's a mouse dog? Like, what does that mean? And like, that's where we sometimes end up having the character design questions. So I'm like, you know, I also kind of like, I think because of my theater background, I like the collaboration of it. So I'm like, well, in my head, it's basically this, but like, let's talk about you. Like, what would be a mouse dog to you?
Right.
Which is a great conversation to have as an adult. So yeah, I think there's been a good back and forth, and you know, as with most collaborations, he would send some art after he had read I'd written a narrative, you know, a longer narrative originally, like a large short story that kind of got us into the world building. And so he would send things from that going like, does this costume make sense? Or like, if I shifted this for her hair, or so it was a lot of like just going back and forth in that way, into the development. But actually, since we've been doing the issues, like, I feel like we found a good rhythm where there's a good trust back and forth of like, okay. You know, and sometimes I'll send photo reference, which he'll then manipulate into something much cooler, where I'll be like, oh, there's a giant monster and it looks like this. And then he'll send it back and I'm like, oh, that monster's better. So it's kind of just getting to like, what are the bases and the bones of each of these, and then kind of talking through like what the full realization of it will look like.
So kind of like building up that trust in the beginning, you know, with talk, and that now you guys probably feel more like, well, I'm going to just use this kind of shorthand thing. And then I know Steve's going to kind of get what I'm saying and add to it. And then it comes back and you end up with a good marriage. Is that kind of how that's working for you guys now?
Absolutely. And if he doesn't get what I'm saying, he has no problem telling me. So that's also been really helpful. I mean, I just think, like, I don't know, for people who are aspiring or working on comics, what I've found is, like, it's just, I feel like your art has to match your book definitively, or else it's hard for the book to work. You know, even, and I think sometimes people take those, like, I need the best, greatest artist. And I'm like, no, you just need the artist who, like, can really convey the tone and energy of what you're writing. Yeah, and then I think outside of that, like, you both just need to have some level of ownership in it. Like, it has to be a real trade back and forth. Like, if I was just dictating things, I don't know how any of the books I've worked on would work. I don't know how, I know there's some artists who are able to work that way. It's kind of surprising me. Like, I like getting the surprise. Like, I like receiving the PDF, you know, of, like, the issue I just wrote and opening it and going, like, oh shit, this is awesome. like someone just sent me a movie of what I wrote. It was incredible.
Yeah, like, I saw it in my head, and now it looks exactly like I expected, or even better than I imagined.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and sometimes I'm like, oh, I was right about that shot, which is also a nice surprise. You're like, yeah, I'm glad we did that angle. That is awesome. So kudos to me. And then there's other times you're like, man, I'm glad he was right, because that's a way better way to do that shot than what I was doing or what I originally thought it might be.
Yeah, I completely agree with your sentiments there. And actually, Ron Mars was on a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about his Kickstarter project, Demigod. And he was talking about, you know, the fact that it was actually Bart Sears that came up with the idea, but Andy Smith ended up working on the project with him rather than Bart, just because they felt that Andy was better suited for it. And so it's not always about, and you know, this goes for you aspiring comic book creators, when you're looking for an artist, just like Sean said, it's not always about finding an established name or a big name or, you know, whatever label you want to put on it, but you need to find the right person for your project. Because no one sets out to make a bad comic. You know, we all have read bad comics, and oftentimes that's when you're trying to fit, you know, square pegs into round holes. You know, you got somebody whose art you love, but it's just not right on that project, but you force it. And that's when you end up with something that doesn't flow or seems choppy, or, you know, halfway through you guys just end up like hating each other. And that's that's not the way to get the best out of your work and get the best out of the creative process.
Yeah, like, I would say the people that I worked with on the first three books I did at Image, they were all first-time comic artists. And all three of them got pretty large notice for their work on it, because we both knew the world we were making. You know, like, we were in Congress together about, like, this is exactly the book that we're making. So every issue, when it came out, it felt really unified. So when people were reading it and liked it, they were like, man, I love this art, because it fits this. I love this story and I love the art, because they're just, like, they're so definitively married. Because I do think people get obsessed with the idea of, like, you know, I need to work with Fiona Staples right now, this moment. And it's like, yeah, there's only so many of her to begin with. But also, like, there's a lot of amazingly talented people that, if they get the shot and if they're put in a good position to succeed, are going to do some incredible work.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Well, again, listeners, Betrothed is going to be out at your comic shops this Wednesday, March 14th. So I very much encourage you to go and pick up the first issue. I've read it, loved it. It's incredible. Is there anything else you want our listeners to know, Sean?
No, I mean, I hope that they pick up Betrothed. I know I'm doing another book with Aftershock after that called Clan Killers, which I encourage you to look for. Very, very different from Betrothed, but it's been awesome, and the artist on that has been amazing. Thanks for buying them. It's amazing to get the opportunity to get to do this. So I'm very, very thankful for that.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back on when the first issue of that next series is going to come out.
Oh, that'd be great.
Okay, so for any of our listeners that want to follow along online, social media, so they know when your work's coming out, where's the best place? Where can they follow you?
I don't have a ton of social media. I mean, the main one is I'm on Twitter at Sean Chris Lewis. And then I have a website that's just SeanChristopherLewis.com. Those are the easiest ways, to kind of see what I'm up to.
All right. And those links will be in the show notes, listeners. So if you want to follow Sean, have any convention appearances coming up, any place I might run into?
Oh yeah. I'll be at C2E2, in Chicago in April. And then I'm hoping in the next year, I've been running a theater company full time for the past 2 years. Yeah, so it's been hard to get away for those, but I free up a lot starting this summer. So I'm hoping that I'll get to get out and actually meet people more often starting this April in Chicago.
Great. So go out, buy the first issue of Betrothed. You could be able to take it to Sean when he's at C2E2, get it signed. I'm sure he'd love to hear your thoughts on the book. So
yeah.
All right, Sean.
Cool. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. I want to thank you for joining me. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for setting all this up.
Oh, not a problem at all. So listeners, if you'd like to listen to previous episodes of the podcast, remember you can go to thecomicsourceblog.com for all past episodes. And I am in the process of migrating over all the audio content to the LRM online site. So that should be done very, very soon. While you're visiting us at lrmonline.com, be sure to check out all the other coverage of pop culture, TVs, movies, video games, all that kind of good stuff. Don't forget, Manny and I will be at WonderCon in Anaheim, California, coming up at the end of the month with a big giveaway for all you Comic Source listeners. So stay tuned for details on that. Don't forget, twitter.com/thecomicsource is where you can find us on Twitter. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us there. Be sure to know when new episodes are released, as well as all our convention coverage. So thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.